Now, back to At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Santa come once, yeah, we all know. Don't use my chimney, gotta keep a man go. Oh. Oh, look what Santa did, messing with me. You call it Merry Christmas, that's the Santa's messing with me.
Well, we did get this one in. Santa's messing with the kid, but it is a personal favorite, so I don't mind all that much. But we'll try to get in all of your At the Races Christmas cuts as the Christmas season unfolds here on the air. That's Eddie Campbell's version, and Skinner's got one as well. There's only one Stacey Clark Rogers, though.
Before we introduce Stacey, yeah. I miss more of the music lead-ins that we had years ago.
It's tough. There's a couple of reasons for it. Part of it is, even though on Sirius, you know, we're fine on the licensing, it's the replays. It's on the iPod, the iTunes system, and those systems. Okay. If they hear recorded, you know, licensed music, they shut down the actual show. So we've got a couple of workarounds of that, but I wish we could. I mean, the music has been a part of the show for forever. So we're playing one Christmas cut. Listen, I used to take commercials every 25 to 28 minutes. Used to literally take six a show. Now I take one. I do two 90-minute segments, which, sounds easy.
it doesn't.
And as I say to people, say, how do you do 3 hours? Sometimes 3 hours isn't enough. It's not going to be enough today. I'll tell you that. Stacey Clark Rogers joining us and checking in. You're always a signpost on the Aftercare Highway and the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, which has made such an impact as a clearinghouse and as an umbrella organization for the aftercare arena, and really galvanized so much about aftercare and just one of the industry's best success stories.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think this is one of the best success stories of our industry, remembering that this was a collaboration in 2011 where people got together and talked about the concerns we had with aftercare, the concerns we had with funding aftercare, and not knowing where our horses were going and if they were going to, you know, what was the end game. So we should be proud of ourselves as an industry, because this has been a great collaboration of a board of 25 people switching off and on. So we probably had 150 different board members, lots of different insight from people over the years. Good industry support. Could be better. We have lots of room to grow. But for sure, we should be proud of where we're at. This is a different picture than we looked at 12 years ago.
Well, ever since I've met you, which is, over 20 years ago probably now, you've talked about this almost kind of be quietly. And for some reason, as an industry, we almost were afraid to talk about it. I don't know.
I think that's that concerns something we see in a lot of our industry stuff. Like early in the development of the Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance, the term euthanasia was a complicated discussion. And we know that it's not fair to keep old horses alive just because, you know, we have to have a euthanasia policy. We wouldn't have talked about medication reform 15 years ago. So we are evolving, and that's a good thing. I think we have awareness is key of where we are and what we want to be as a sport and as an industry as well, because, you know, it's not just the racing people, it's the breeding farms, it's the feed, you know, like Hallway Feeds and all the big farms that industry support that is counting on the horse racing industry and the thoroughbred to thrive.
And a couple, just a little bit of that background, because I always, you know, when I say what a success story it is, it's not simply just that the organization, you know, is out there as an entity and is operating successfully. What specifically transpired and what the TAA was able to alleviate. The flashpoint, of course, was a very unfair attack on the Thoroughbred Retirement Foundation by the New York Times. And while some very valid points were raised, the method and the essential, not sabotage, but the way in which it was foisted on TRF was grossly unfair. However, there was a huge benefit because it sort of brought into focus, for instance, TRF's the outlandish obligation that they had that nobody really understood, that they were taking a retired horse at five and keeping it maintained for 27 years.
Right.
And they had taken on too many horses.
Yes.
And it, in addition to that specific circumstance, there was also something that I don't think people, I don't know anybody else who brings this up. There was tremendous infighting and backbiting between the retirement organizations, mm-hmm. fighting for funding,
yes.
and ridiculing each other,
yes.
and you know, saying, oh, they're no good, don't give them money. That it was such an unpleasant environment and a toxic environment, mm-hmm. and the TAA ended that, stopped it in its tracks, because the accreditation program and basically having someone as a clearinghouse say, this one, you know, these people are accredited, these people are accredited, these people are doing a job that you know makes them worthy of your
funding and
funding.
Time.
Exactly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So all of that went away.
Mm-hmm.
And if the TAA did nothing else other than solve those two immediate issues, it was going to be a success. But it's gone much further than that, and it's elevated everybody's operation. Simultaneous, and without any encouragement from the industry, Stuart Pittman had conceived of a program
RP.
That literally mm-hmm. has transformed this to the extent where Robert Hartman an hour ago said that 25% of his enrollees mm-hmm. in the RTIP want to be in aftercare.
That's wonderful.
As a profit center and a profit-driven
yes.
concept.
As possible. Yes.
And it's all because of Stuart. And what the Retired Racehorse Project and the makeover, taking essentially a horse that
it was very kismet, yes.
Was yeah. God knew what mm-hmm. value it had mm-hmm. and turned it into a horse that could be sold for $30,000, $50,000, $70,000.
Mm-hmm.
It's remarkable.
Yeah, there is a lot of kismet in the scenarios of where we were at in 2011. Stuart started the program in Maryland at Pimlico, as you recall, and it was a smaller program, and it grew. When the Breeders' Cup first came to Keeneland, it was very insightful for him to start the program at the horse park that same year. And I think as we've paralleled our progress and if we've grown together, we work closely with RRP. We are one of their contributors every year. We like to support the horses that we see that go from our TA accredited groups to go into that program. And at the same time, it also, we have the TIPS program that went with the Jockey Club, and we've got Karma, and we've got all these amazing groups that have come together. We're all friends. We work together well. We like to talk about the problems and the issues. There's still issues in aftercare. There's still funding issues in aftercare. But the reality is we can have these conversations like grown-ups and realize that, you know, and I think the reason to what you said, Steve, about, you know, the infighting was, you have to remember, up until 2011 or until TRF was pulled out in that New York Times article, no one talked about aftercare. No one talked about their struggles. They weren't part of, you know, breeding, foaling, training, racing, selling. It wasn't part of that cycle. Now we can say that the aftercare world is now part of the cycle of the thoroughbred industry and part of the life. And so they feel included and they feel less threatened as individual organizations, and they want to work together. Most of them want to work together.
I agree with you 100% on that. And you brought up Karma, and of course mm-hmm. Karma was started in California, Madeline Arbach.
Mm-hmm.
Got that going, and I remember when it started, and you know, she was very determined person. She wants to get
very determined.
She'll get it done, and she came up with the concept. Okay, here's what we're going to do.
Yeah,
we're going to take X amount of the purse, you know, whatever it was, whatever the number
yeah.
was,
one third of 1% of the winning. Whatever,
yep. I was going to say $10, yeah, but yeah. something along those yeah. lines. Yeah. Not a whole lot, and they're going to have to opt out. They don't want it, rather than opt in.
Yeah.
I remember going, thinking, "Wow,
Don't get Madeline's way."
Yes. But it was genius to
yes.
rather than opt in,
yes.
to opt out.
Yes.
And all of a sudden, now everyone was contributing without even knowing they were. It's like yeah. a 401k type of
yes.
thing. You never saw it, so it was that. And so, it was like, wow, this is a great idea. And that, on the West Coast, opened a lot of people's eyes to aftercare.
And giving trainers and owners a solution. I think that it's what to do. They don't know.
And you're right, not to do. You know, there were a group of people that had already had what they were going to do with their horse, but a very small percentage.
Yes.
Where a lot of owners wanted to do something, but they didn't have an outlet.
Yeah.
And now it's an outlet. I use it when there's a disaster happening somewhere. People want to give, but tell me where to give.
Right.
And I kind of think it's the same way with the horse. And then your group comes along. Explain, like Steve said, the accreditation factor.
Yeah.
Where money comes in and it doesn't.
Yeah. So we do two things. So, and just a shout out to Carmen and Madeline and Lucinda. They were very, very important in the beginning of the structure of the TA because they had the experience of 5 years of, they had interviewed organizations and had some sort of due diligence that they did and fundraising. And so their advice was very strong and it was very helpful. And they still, to this day, are members and affiliates to the TA. The TA does two things, and we accredit and we fundraise. So the accreditation part is what sets us apart from anything else. So going out and looking at the horses, everyone has to send an application. That'll come online January 13th this year. You apply, the application closes April 1st, and then we start a conveyor belt of due diligence. We have two or three reviews of the application. Once the committee, which has been meeting for, get this, 12 years, every Wednesday from May 1st to October 30th. And they're the same group. It's incredible. And so that group will review the application. And once we've looked at the application two or three times, found some things that are maybe missing, we need to contact the group. We try and help them get across the goal line. Then we send out an inspector. We send out inspectors. We do about 120 inspections average a year for the TAA. Every second year, you have every one of your organizations reviewed. Every year, you have at least one of your facilities reviewed. So that conveyor belt of protocol is what really sets the TAA apart and gives the investor into aftercare real confidence if you're investing into the TAA or into the individual group, right?
Yeah, somebody wants to know, if I'm thinking, okay, I'm going to give these people my old horse, or not old, but old racehorse, and new, looking for a new horse. Who are they? I trust them? And
we get that question a couple times a week, right? People who don't have. So my dream is to have a track affiliate everywhere you go. So like we have in Karma with Lucinda, a trainer, Doug O'Neill knows, I'll go talk to Lucinda. Same thing we have at Gulfstream, Maryland, New York. My dream is to have a point person at every track. In fact, we have a placement, best practices for placement programs. And then that sort of gives them the confidence of where to go. And then if they want to give, like we'd like to get the money, but we also understand that in the community of your state or your racing community, you might want to give there too. So we've never planned on being 100% of any organization's funding. We want them to want to be accredited, and therefore, the carrot at the end of the stick of getting your accreditation is funding, but it really does help to understand and we do the due diligence. And everybody in racing wants to worry about what they're worrying about, whether you're in sales or, the racing secretary or you're doing the radio show. You want to do your job, and then aftercare, you know that you've put a lot of good work into this as an industry, that it's working.
Yeah, it's so open now to talk about, and I actually hear people being so proud of their
the industry should be proud
but of their individual horse and what my horse is doing. Mine's on a farm in Oregon, and mine it's kind of cool to hear that.
And to the point of the RRP, I mean, one of the problems we had in 2011 when we talk about TRF and the concerns we had as an industry, one of them was the versatility of the thoroughbred wasn't recognized. We went through a whole sport horse flood of warm bloods coming into horse sports, and the whole time we're going, well, wait, this horse used to go to the Olympics. The thoroughbred was an incredible breed. Now, that goes hand in hand with the corrections and medication, right? The thoroughbred we're retraining now for sport horses is much sounder in mind because we're not retraining a horse that came off of equipoise, right, or Winstall. Like, that's a different racehorse. And you really, as a retrainer and all these young people that want to do retraining, which is fantastic, having the medication reform, not only to stop people from doing that one last race, but also having the medication reform so you get a mentally sound horse, right? That's a different animal, right?
The medication the medication story is kind of a strange, there's a obviously a quirky sidebar to this, involving slaughter.
Right.
The benefit of medicated horses is they can't go into international food chains.
But they did anyway.
In some cases, they probably did. And this is a topic, you know, that is just maddening. The inability for not just us, but everybody that is trying to get the SAFE Act home and essentially, you know, end the slaughter
shipping
pipeline
horses,
of any in any way, shape, or form. I'm not looking to throw the quarter horse industry under the bus, but yet when this topic comes up. Thoroughbred, because I suppose of the high visibility of our owners and of the game's personalities, mm-hmm. We're probably 20% of the problem. Quarter horse industry, 70%.
Well, again, it comes to inventory control. Where are we, right?
Yes, and yet we're the ones that have had to take the slings and arrows and stand up for equestrian sport in 100%. General.
I agree with you 100%.
And it's a little frustrating.
Yeah.
And I, like I said, I'm not trying to. But,
and I don't think it's just quarter horses. I think this is, like you said, equestrian sports.
But if we fall, they are an avalanche of discarded young horses.
Yes.
More than anybody, more than anything else.
Well, what goes with the exposure on the positive end also gets more questions. I get asked more questions because they hear the word.
Right.
Well, what happens to the horse? Now, guess what? I have an answer
you
now.
You have a positive answer.
Where before was, some do this, some do that. I can actually say that, we have organizations called, PAA that the horses are retrained and sent out to, happily recipients.
And we've advised other breeds, so the standard bred people have spent quite some time with us establishing their alliance. We've advised other countries. Jamaica has been working on a great program. We've worked with people in England and Japan.
What about Puerto Rico?
Puerto Rico is a difficult scenario.
Puerto Rico is a problem.
Yes.
It's a terrible problem.
I think some of the tracks, when Aidan Butler and Mike Rogers put out the statement that you weren't allowed to ship horses from your track and come back and get stalls if you went to Puerto Rico. And those are great things because we need more inventory control of when our horses leave the track and when they go from all points of view. Puerto Rico is difficult because Puerto Rico doesn't want the racing in Puerto Rico doesn't want to admit they have an issue, and they don't have the same outlook we do for social consciousness of the importance of the sentient being, right? This is, and so until that culture change happens and Puerto Rico realizes the vulnerability that they have, then we're in a difficult spot.
You have to take each little block and try and tackle it as it goes.
Yeah, it's look, we're better than we were 10, 15 years ago, and from HISA to medication to all the things that we're doing, it's progressive. It's a better, healthy horse. As Michael Blowen always says, let's just put the horse first.
Yes, and I heard it right from him 2 weeks ago. I was on the farm with him.
He's my mentor.
You can't say his name and not smile.
No,
right?
He's the best.
He's phenomenal.
He's the greatest, as he would say.
And he is.
For those that didn't see my tweet over, I think it was Saturday night, Tina and I were watching season 7 of Homicide: Life on the Street. are you aware of his?
I don't think I'd watch that, but okay.
I missed that one. I got 6, but I need to get to 7.
Well, that's the final season, and Michael Blowen is in an episode.
Oh gosh,
it's hysterical. Oh, where, and of course, at the time he was still the active
film critic
of the
mm-hmm.
Boston Globe, and he plays a theater goer at the old Senator Theater in Baltimore.
Oh, that's funny. I have to watch now.
An annoying theater goer who is murdered in the theater, and the character's name is Michael Blowen, and I put up a fabulous picture of Michael laying there with his tongue hanging out. It's my favorite moment.
Oh, I have something on him now. This is great. Okay, thanks.
It sounds like a Larry David cameo, right?
It's the best.
Yeah, exactly.
Stacey, as always, thanks,
you.
We'll be watching for your episode, for your presentation in just about an hour?
Yes.
All right.
All right, thanks a lot, guys. Appreciate your time.
Always a pleasure, Stacey. You know that.
Whatever you
All right.
Need.
Okay, we'll see you in Vegas.
Thoroughbred Aftercare Alliance's Stacey Clark Rogers, who was doing this work before it became fashionable.
Yes, she was.
And the same could be said of our next guest. Lisa Lazarus, good morning.
Good morning. How are you both doing?
Good, Lisa.
Great.
We're good, and we appreciate the chance to talk. I know you've got a little window here before you got to get into a HIWU meeting. Since we talked last week,
a lot has happened.
Well, we had Alan. Alan talked about, you know, the dispute.
Okay,
and I don't want to call it a lawsuit. It's a dispute.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Explain from your perspective where you are on the assessments and what this is going to mean.
Sure. So when HISA was first launched back in 2022, the HISA board essentially came up with an assessment formula that determines, you know, what fees or what portion of HISA's budget each state and therefore track is required to pay. And thinking at the time was, you know, we really want to make sure that we maintain the ecosystem of racing. There are a number of smaller tracks that don't have the resources of a Churchill or a Naira. And so we want to give those racetracks an opportunity to essentially upgrade their safety and integrity and be able to do that in the manner that it does not essentially, you know, shut them down or is not too burdensome from them. So ultimately what the board decided to do was they decided to consider purses alongside starts, so that essentially the way that I look at it is, you know, the same way that Major League Baseball doesn't make, you know, the Yankees and the Brewers, you know, pay the same amount of money in terms of revenue sharing, is that it didn't make sense at the outset when we launched to essentially have these bigger, far more resource racetracks paying the same amount really as, you know, a Belterra or a Thistledown or, and so we were really quite proud of that methodology and the importance of preserving the small tracks and giving them an opportunity to sort of do the right thing on safety and integrity in a way that was possible for them. And that's why the assessment was created the way that it was. It's been implemented since the beginning. There's been no change to the regulation. Since the outset, Churchill and Naira have pushed back on the formula, and we have, because HISA has actually managed our money very effectively and has been under budget every year,
right,
we've been able to sort of carry that delta as we work through trying to reach a resolution. But it just came to a point where, you know, we could no longer do that and operate effectively. And so we tried to find resolutions with both of them. Neither were open to a resolution. And so we had to treat them the same way that we treat any other track that doesn't pay their bills.
What came up, and Rick, are you going to go in the direction?
No, go ahead.
The one concern that seems to be easy to extrapolate, racetracks that have year-round programs, potentially, who could probably least afford the assessment, could be potentially burdened by the direction you're going.
And you planned on switching back to that in 2006, isn't that?
So there's no, first of all, there's no back. It's always been the way that it's currently enforced, which is half purses and half starts. There's a proposal in front of the Federal Trade Commission to move to pure starts in 2026. And the thinking behind that was, we've now given, you know, these smaller tracks 4 years to get up to speed, and that now we should essentially be charging based on volume as opposed to based on, you know, relative capacity to pay.
So the concern is, you know, a smaller track. I'm just going to do a Charlestown or a Penn National that runs 200.
We don't regulate Charlestown, but yeah.
Okay,
Penn National.
Excuse me. I'm sorry about that.
West Virginia.
Penn National. Yeah.
The buzzer went off. but you know, other than Penn National parks, something like those that race 200 plus days a year, you know, they're going to have a much larger burden than they do now. And obviously, the concern, the quick concern, without digging a little deeper, is, how are they going to afford it?
So the reason why, you know, this is going into effect in 2026, assuming that the Federal Trade Commission approves the rule change, is that we are working on a number of different ways to find revenue outside the industry that can alleviate some of the burden on the industry. So the hope and expectation is that by 2026, we'll have either revenue that comes from, you know, either some commercial initiatives that we engage in to help the industry, or some tax possibilities, either state level or federal level. We're working very hard on all of those initiatives, because I don't think that relying on the industry is sustainable long term. And if and frankly, if we can't make that happen, we will have to, in my view, cut back on our budget so that we're, you know, so that it's affordable. Because, you know, obviously, from my standpoint, I want to be able to continue to develop and innovate and do the best for the industry. And to do that, you know, you need a certain amount of funding. But my expectation is that we'll get that additional funding elsewhere, and not from the industry.
Well, that's encouraging, without a doubt. So internally, in some of those expenses, you know, obviously a lot in testing and a lot of that. And are you looking into ways to maybe find, you know, a more economically favorable way to test?
80% of our budget is the anti-doping program.
Right.
Lab analysis, testing, legal, all of that. So yes, we are looking, what we're looking at now is the data and essentially what has produced the best result or the best outcome, the best bang for our buck in terms of ensuring integrity. And we're going to sort of double down on those and then lighten up on others and look for cost savings there.
Well, that's great. And dig in a little bit farther. We had a little meeting on Monday, and Hai Wu was in there and talking to Ben. And specifically, I just want to get into talking about testing. We had a big problem a year ago about the timing coming back. And
yes.
You know,
And is that Kentucky Downs? Yeah, or what?
Just in general, just testing going, you know, back and forth, getting the blood back, and that has kind of gone away. I asked the question. Anybody in here having no hands went up?
Yeah.
So either you've economically found a better way to do it, or get it done.
Well, we actually did. To be honest, is that there were some labs that were underperforming, and we got rid of those labs.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really the end of the day. You know, we're dependent on the lab adhering to their contractual obligations. Right. And so the biggest problems were happening, particularly in Kentucky, because that lab was not operating at the level that it should be. And they were testing Kentucky and Florida. And so we've really pressed down on that. We've also come up with some other, you know, HIWU has some other electronic reporting tools that have made it also more efficient. But a big part of that was weeding out the labs that weren't performing.
And chances are, if they weren't performing, they're probably costing more too.
Yeah.
You know, it seems to be.
Ironically,
right?
That's not true.
No.
Ironically, that's not true. Kentucky was one of our most expensive labs, and they were, you know, in my view, the worst performer.
Well, that's what I meant.
Yeah.
They were costing more by being efficient.
Yes. I thought you said the opposite. Yes.
No.
Yes.
So.
Absolutely.
So,
absolutely.
Good.
So, that is true.
One thing that does appear to be working is the overall focus on, you know, the issues at large. And yesterday, Lisa, and I want you to take a bit of a victory lap here. And we touched on it with some of the in a little bit, Chris, in about half an hour. All right, Chris Katulak will stop by with Nebraska bubbling up. And I know Nebraska's a problematic
It's not actually problematic. We hope that we can find a financial solution for Nebraska that makes sense.
Well, it'll be a lot easier for them when the money starts flowing.
Yes, exactly.
Around the.
So I think for them, it's really a money issue. At least that's the way I understand it.
Talk about the presentation and the discussion yesterday, because the per capita, the per thousand rate. Mm-hmm. Is at an all-time low, and you know, for all of the complaints on any topic around the game, it is kind of ridiculous that no one acknowledges the areas of success, and considering that, you know, health and safety, health and welfare of the racehorse, it is everybody's rallying cry. You would think that being at an all-time low since they started tracking the numbers would be something we could all share in and applaud and celebrate together.
Yeah, listen, I agree. And I have to say, you know, HISA has certainly been a big part of that, but it wouldn't have happened without industry cooperation, without a lot of people working incredibly hard, horsemen, veterinarians, et cetera. And I do think that there's a lot of pride in that. And I do think that just the culture of safety is really permeating. But yeah, it's a victory lap that we should all take and something that we should be working on, you know, together. And I'm always, I think you know, I'm always an advocate of, I wish there wasn't, you know, a lot of this dissension within the industry. I wish we could all be rowing together in the same direction. I'm a pretty flexible person, so I think I could, you know, reach a resolution with anybody who actually really wanted to find a resolution. And hopefully, once we get beyond the Supreme Court, we can all, we can sort of put all this behind us and work together as an industry.
I always ask you, I mean, as you constantly review the data and as the systems are tweaked and everybody, you know, tries to adjust, I mean, there are areas seemingly on the ground that are, that continue to be just difficult for not for people to accept, but just to incorporate in a manner that, you know, that is comfortable.
Right.
The racetrack practitioners feel put upon,
yes,
and the trainers feel countermanded in several directions, whether it's from track management, taking acute, making acute focus of the monitoring of entries, the you know, the burdensome reporting of things, including now, you know, the process involved in even getting a horse scheduled for a workout.
Yeah.
I mean, there's parts of this, Lisa, that feel like an hourglass, you know, where there's just so much sand and only one grain can go through at a time, if that's a good way to describe it.
Yeah.
How do we grease the skids and or is it just a growing process that requires constant adjustment?
So one thing is we've definitely put a lot of focus on developing tools for veterinarians that make their lives easier. You know, we have a number of different apps. We even now have a product that we hope to launch very soon that's based on artificial intelligence where the vet can just basically talk a question into their phone about a particular horse and get an answer immediately. So always looking on ways to make it easier because I do think the veterinarians, have difficult jobs and we just need more veterinarians. I mean, that's really a big part of it. We need to attract more veterinarians.
Rob Hartman talked about that itself.
That's a huge, that's a huge component. I mean, it's a hard job and we need more. And the scheduling for a workout is not a Heisman thing. That's a state thing, but that being said, it's just because there's a dearth of, there aren't enough veterinarians, you know? And so that's kind of what I think happens.
You're 100% right. Yeah. And I hear a lot back from a lot of veterinarians. There's a little bit more pressure on them to get some stuff done. But what I'm hearing the little bit of a push to get back to a little more personal care, a little bit more talking back and forth, a little more communicating the way it used to be.
Yes.
To where they would rather than see a horse that maybe is not looking 100% and say, well, who's that horse we're putting on a list?
Yeah.
Let's now go talk to the trainer to his vet and let's see what we can do to
do
that. And so I'm feeling, you know, we always have to wait till I always use the pendulum. We don't do it from here. We wait till it goes all the way to the top. And I'm feeling a from both sides, a willingness to, you know, communicate a little bit more and let's not be, you know, I heard with the new 150-day rule,
it's
for that, okay? And we're given a little bit of a easement on the time, a little bit more, you know, maybe support. If the guy, person doing the right thing and it's, a, you know, hey, but this rule lasts for 30 days, you know, there's a reason why maybe the 32nd day, it's like, okay, you know, let's be reasonable here and extend
for sure.
This.
And I think we have been, you know, on those points, I think we have been reasonable and we're trying to be. I mean, that's really the philosophy is, this is all about, you know, what's good for the industry, what's good for the horses.
Right.
And so let's just kind of figure what that is together. And it's not, you know, it's never, I think, Heise's intention to have these harsh rules that, you know, we're not willing to talk about.
Well, I think at the beginning it was the intention and maybe you had to do that, but I'm feeling a more of a human approach to it. And, you know, that's encouraging.
Great.
Because these, not we mentioned just the vets, but the trainers, they're under the pressure too.
Yeah.
And, you know, lots of times they are doing the right thing and we're feeling like, oh my gosh, there's that wall. I can't, that we have to start over again. And I'm just feeling a little bit of a release in that, which is a good thing.
That's great. I do think that there's, you know, the trainers are concerned about, you know, levels and contamination. where that really currently in our system is not something that they should be overly concerned about, because I think it's addressed, and we don't have the kind of problems or the potential situations that we had at the outset, because we figured out a way to deal with that with the appropriate rules and the appropriate levels. So I think that's, I really do feel like moving forward that there's going to be a lot more, I think, support for the operations and the way that things are playing out.
Lisa Lazarus, everybody, CEO of HISA. And I know you've got the HIWU meeting, mm-hmm. and as always, we applaud the dedication and the commitment and the openness and everything.
Thank you, Steve.
You're putting into it.
Thank you, Steve. Thank you, Rick. We're gonna keep on. We're gonna keep fighting the good fight.
Gotta do it.
I mean, just from what I understand too, you had a chance. Your former employers came calling to try to get you back, and you stayed the course here, and that should be acknowledged.
Yeah. Well, thank you. This is this job is really important to me, and I'm not going anywhere until they kick me out. So hope to see you here next year.
Very good.
Right. Lisa Lazarus, everybody.
Thank
and
thanks, Lisa.
She is late to a meeting, so we appreciate it so much. And for those that aren't aware, her former employer was something they called the National Football League, she could have easily gone back, and she said no. Jay Hovde and Aaron Grider stride in, and we've got them for 15 minutes. As everybody's got commitments somewhere and somehow, right?
I can stay all day,
except for you.
Yeah,
commitments are over.
I got nothing.
He got to the coffee shop. That ended that commitment.
Yeah, no, Aaron does have a commitment because he's a very busy executive, and I'm just a semi in work author.
Well, it's always great to have Jay Privman on the show.
Thank you very much.
As opposed to semi-auto.
Thank you very much, Steve Anderson.
Well, Steve Anderson's name is the most ubiquitous, because there's Steve Anderson from the service industry over here. He's got his
with an E?
His equipment. Yes, with an E. There was Steve, the late Steve Anderson from Iowa, right? And then of course Steve Anderson from the Daily Racing Form. And for the longest time, I used to write Steve Anderson, and the one in, I think it was Iowa, that he would say, "No, you got Steve in Iowa." Aaron and Jay, well armed, a thoroughbred of destiny, and you rode him, and Bill Kasner and the Windstar team owned him, and I had Owen Hardy the other day. Owen was unhappy with the picture that he thought he deserved to be on the cover.
Well, that's Owen. You know, he's got that Irish ego going, but he certainly is a big part of the story. There's no question. Owen and Bill and Aaron and right on down the line, the whole staff behind it. But it's at the end of the day, it's a real family story, and how a horse kind of represented and carried the torch for a family that was emotionally shattered.
And you know that's a story, and I'll let you expand on that. But I mean, how did this bubble to the surface as a book?
Well, I'll take the floor from Aaron briefly here. Bill, wanted the story told, Bill Kasner, and there was a very, very good mini documentary done about the connection between his family and the horse and the death of his younger daughter. And he reached out to me, and that week I wasn't doing anything, and a couple of years later, here's the book. And it was a story that not only deserved to be told, but really needed to be told, because we have a lot of stories in racing that kind of fly by quickly. They get their 30 seconds on a TV screen, and then they're off and gone, and hopefully this story will last quite a long time.
I hate to bring tragedies to the fore, but there seemed to have been a concentration of industry people that were hit by deaths of children, the Reeds, the Fernandos, the Kasners in a fairly tight window. It was just heartbreaking.
That's true, and of course that's not the whole story, because the story is about Well Armed the Horse,
right.
and what Aaron accomplished aboard the horse. I didn't know this. Aaron had it, and he can talk about. He rode Well Armed's Dam one time, and it was one of those kind of things, if I recall our conversation, Aaron, it just sort of bubbled to the surface when I mentioned that horse's name, that mare's name,
sure.
That you rode at Delaware that day in the Oaks.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. It's a
Well-Dressed was her name.
Well-Dressed. It's horses bring so many people emotions. They become fans for different reasons. But this was a horse that obviously he did a lot for my career, bringing me to a level across the world. But he was much more than just a great horse. He was a great story that he was running with a purpose. And, you know, Mr. Kasner and the time and the patience that he had after his injury, he made sure that this horse had every opportunity to, if only to be just a great horse on the farm, to be healthy and to represent his daughter. This horse was born on his daughter's birthday several years after she passed. And, you know, so there was so many connections of why this horse was special. And, you know, I was very fortunate to come across him. And, you know, we had great communication with Mr. Kasner and with Owen and the horse himself. So it was just a fun ride for me.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that when he showed up in North America, you're the only person that ever rode him, at least on the North American front.
Yes, sir.
And right after Owen took over.
Yes, sir. He was a very good horse. When I first started getting on him, he was a bit aggressive. He was just a very good horse. And when you allowed him to take the bridle a little bit, he sure wanted to run with it. And, you know, over time, he just got to be where he would really relax for me. And, you know, we just got along really well. And the day he ran in the Dubai World Cup, it was just a calm, relaxed stride that he had. And, you know, he beat the gate out of the first jump. He was 3/4 of length in front. And I said, after a quarter of a mile, I said, it's going to take a hell of a horse to beat him today. He's just the way he was, and so calm and relaxed. So he was sure a fun ride, and I love that he's still on the farm and doing well, and he's had a good life, you know, after his injury. He had a great life in racing, and then he sure been treated well at the farm. So,
well, and you went back-to-back years with him to Nadal Sheba.
Yes. He ran third in the first one.
That was against Curlin,
yes, and got beat ahead for second, but really, really ran well. Then we went back to California, went back on the synthetics, and he handled the synthetics extremely well. He did everything well, in good manner, and had a good stride on it. But I remember telling Owen when we were going back to Dubai, I only rode him once on the dirt, but I felt his stride was different, and, you know, I was really excited to get back onto the dirt. So he was good on any distance, and I shouldn't say any distance, the mile, when we rode him in the mile and the Breeders' Cup, it kind of took him off his stride, because it's a quicker pace going into the first turn, and I didn't get that flow from his stride, and that wasn't his fault at all. But he was just a special horse. He would adapt to anything, ship him wherever you put him and whatever track surface he was on.
We have to remember what kind of context that the Well Arms 14-length record win in the World Cup was a part of that year. He set the stage for Rachel Alexandra's undefeated season, for Zenyatta undefeated season, winning the Breeders' Cup Classic. And the racing of 2009, if we ever want a golden mini era, Well Armed was a big part of it, and that was... I mean, to win the Dubai World Cup at that point by 14 lengths, we're not talking about a weak field. Oh, you know, they were still assembling very, very good fields at that point. It was still on the dirt. It was at Nadal Sheba. It was actually the last time they ran it at little Nadal Sheba compared to Big Maidan. It was a special event in the context of an already very special event, and for Well Armed and Aaron and Owen and Bill to have accomplished that night was, I mean, we all know where we were when we saw that race.
I'll tell you how impressive his win was in the Dubai World Cup. When he won and won by 14 lengths, some people said, you know, it wasn't that big of strong of a field, and, you know, he just ran the race of his life. Well, he did run the race of his life, but the next year, Gloria DeCampio, who was second and got beat 14 lengths, came back to win the Dubai World
That's
Cup.
That's right.
So
that's right.
It justifies how good he was, and he was always consistent.
You bring up an interesting point about his prowess on dirt and the fact that in California at that point, at Del Mar and at Santa Anita, I don't think he ran at Hollywood.
Yes, he did.
He did run at Hollywood?
Yes, he ran a mile and an eighth at Hollywood Park and beat a really good field that day, because I went back and looked. The horse that ran second, I ended up riding him for Bob Baffert, paid $96 to, I forget which stake it was, but yeah, I paid $96 to win a stake. So he was beating a good field in an allowance race, but we knew he was special.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, there it is, actually. Right. Oh, yeah. His second start in the U.S. at Hollywood. You're 100%. But my question is, had synthetic not been mandated in California by CHRP, what kind of a career would he have had he raced exclusively on dirt?
Well, if you talk to Bill Kasner and Owen, he wouldn't have had any career at all, because training on synthetics kept him sound.
Absolutely. So that's interesting. But yet, when he had the opportunity, and he actually broke his maiden at Nat Al Sheba as a 3-year-old, right?
Mm-hmm.
After racing, yeah. I mean, the timeline was that they had a very growthy young horse who turned out badly and wasn't really conformed properly for a real hard, hardy dirt career. So they sent him to England, to Clive Britton. And then Clive thought he was good enough to go to Dubai in the winter. And then he hurt himself there, came back, and onward with the story in America. But he needed to be watched carefully for soundness all his life. And the synthetic tracks were given a lot of credit for keeping him sound so that he could perform like he did on the dirt at Dubai.
That's amazing. And that's an interesting sidebar, because, of course, we've heard, in this next generation of synthetic surfaces, and essentially the Tapeta era, because there's nobody else is really, making synthetic surfaces. But the training, we've heard so many people, Mark Cassie comes to mind, about, training on Tapeta and then racing on dirt. I mean, that he, in terms of staying sound, it's a theme. I got the nicest note here from our friend Karen Glassman. She says one of her fondest memories of racing of any ilk is you padding well-armed on the neck the whole length of the stretch as you were just airing.
Well, it was just, he had done it for me more than I did it for him. We got along well, but it was like he put me in that spotlight or in a position where I could go and travel around the world and win some of these major races. And, just the teamwork that it was, I just wanted to tell him thank you. So, it was just appreciation. And he ran hard, and I said, just enjoy the ride, because I am.
Obviously, Owen was over there. I mean, Owen had this horse ready to roll. Had he been over there prior, whether it was with Bob or at any other time, to put him in that position to get this horse ready, and knew what he had to do to get him ready for that trip? And
well, he had run the year before against Curlin, so, and then he broke his maiden in Dubai originally, but this year when we went, they asked me to go early, so I was out there for 10 days because they wanted me to breeze him. They said, we don't want him to go too fast. You get along good with him. So I flew over there and breezed him. But he just trained magnificent all week long when we were there, and he was ready. I remember getting on in the paddock. Mr. Kasner patted me on the arm where Patch was with his daughter, and he said, she's riding with you. Let's get it home. I said, we got this one.
And of course, as far as Owen's experience in Dubai, we know that very well.
That's what I meant.
Yeah, sure. He, of course, he'd been there with a couple of Bob Baffert World Cup horses, and then he was hired by Godolphin to take care of their 2-year-olds in the winter and bring them to America for a few seasons. So he was thoroughly, thoroughly versed in what it took to train and to win in the atmosphere at Dubai.
And I'm sure that experience went a long way, and just knowing the trip, getting there, what to do when you get there, and what it takes to get that horse in position. And speaking of that, I was asking about coming home, bringing the horses home after making the trip to all the way there. does it really take that much out, type of thing? And I got the response. Todd was telling me, he said, you know, we used to make the trip, run the race, and then the next day fly him home. So now we leave him there for a week and fly him back. And it's, you know, of course, it depends on the individual, but generally it is a lot easier than for them to get back into the adapting to here. So maybe a chance to get back onto the track a little bit quicker than just doing the boom, boom, boom.
Right.
So,
and
not that interesting.
Usually they've used the San Diego handicap for a good springboard to get back on horses that have come from Dubai. So when he ran third the first year in 2008, he came back and won the San Diego handicap. And got several months off, you know, in between, so he freshened up and was in great form that year, throughout that year. But then the following year when he won, his last race was in the San Diego handicap. And, you know, he just wasn't, I just felt something wasn't right with him. I knew him well. You know, he surely didn't pull up bad. It was just, I just knew something wasn't perfect with him. And I eased him up, and just understanding him and him understanding me. And that was his final race. And fortunately, you know, he was okay, and you give him time, and now he's having a happy life on the farm and healthy. And so
Aaron took good care of him that day, and he came out with a minor fracture that was just like his message to say, haven't I done enough? And no one could disagree with him.
Well, well-armed, a thoroughbred of destiny, Jay Hovde, and opportunities. Are there more opportunities for signatures?
Well, we had a wonderful signing last night. At the RTIP conference at the Global Symposium here. And the book is available at its own dedicated website, wellarmedbook.com, just like it sounds, wellarmedbook.com. And we're hopefully going to have something at Santa Anita early in the meet there to be announced.
Well, speaking of which, Aaron Greider, weeks were really... Today's the 11th, so we're 15 days away from opening at Santa Anita, of course, Boxing Day, one of the great traditional opening days in the sport. And yeah, got a couple of, obviously, there's some issues. We're not gonna sugarcoat, you know, the situation, but still highly anticipated the winter at the great race place.
It's always opening day there is always great. It's you know, the holidays. Families are together, they come out, we get a good crowd, and we sure put on a good card that day. And we're just hoping for, you know, to continue that and have a very successful, you know, winter meet, and we're all excited.
Aaron Greider, everybody, with First Racing and 3,900 plus wins, right?
In America, a little over 4,000 worldwide.
When you add up the, that's a good point, that's a great point. They should, they shouldn't, that's a good point. Equipage should include the international.
They do some tracks, but others they don't. Right. Yeah, so.
Any match races? Any, you know, no. Wink, wink, little...
No, thank you.
Look, he started at Caliente. That's tough enough as a background, so give him credit for that.
I love that. You weren't the guy that invented the tequila sunrise.
But I've had a few.
But Caliente was a real deal when
you
started. It wasn't like, that place down there. It was... people used to venture. I was one of them, and many times going across the border there to go to the races at Caliente.
I've got to pass the mic over. I've got another meeting to get on, but I appreciate you guys. So hold on here. Give it to Jay.
Aaron Greider, everybody. And we've got Chris Katulak from Fauner Park is going to stop by. We've got Corey Johnson that's going to pop in as well. Jay, what else do you want? There must be other plugs. Do we have
no other plugs?
No Julie plugs.
Julie's doing fine without my plug.
What about the documentary?
Documentary is still out there being marketed, right. And we're hoping to hear some good news soon.
Excellent. But it's in the can.
No, it's not in the can.
Oh, it's not in the can.
No. It's still in. The project is being marketed to screening services and producers all over Hollywood. So it's we're getting some good vibes.
Where are we going to see Lorelei next?
Lorelei will be on stage at MiraCosta Community College in the ensemble with Singing in the Rain in February.
Outstanding. I knew you had plugs.
Thanks so much, you guys.
Jay Hovde, everybody, always a treat. And that was a chance to. Do you need this? I've got a copy at home.
It's yours.
Oh, thank you so much. Did you guys sign it?
I didn't sign it.
Well, because I've got one at home that Kasner signed. which was very nice.
I can do a good Jay Hefty in case he doesn't want to do it.
Let me. We're gonna end up. Boy, there was way too many individuals. Corey Johnson and Chris Katulak are gonna sit them down together. Jay, thank you.
Thank you
so much. You know, because in a number of ways, the topic kind of suits both. Corey Johnson, good morning.
Good morning.
Always great to see you.
Yeah, you too, Steve.
You've always got an iron in the fire, you devil, you.
And so do you always.
Well, I got no choice. Chris Katulak as well, and I'm sort of referencing a little bit that we've got new things on the horizon, and obviously, Chris, you and I touched on it in February when your season launched at Fonner Park, but the new Nebraska circuit inches closer every day.
Yes. Good morning, Rick. Good morning, Jay. Jay just left. I had to follow. Yesterday I was going to have to follow Baffert, and I dodged that bullet. Today I have to follow Jay Hovde, and I get to be with Corey Johnson here right now. Steve and Corey and I were young pups together back in the day, lifetime ago. Never worked with Corey, but certainly we were doing our things in the Midwest or wherever that was. Corey with DeBartolo and me, you know, working around Nebraska and going to Louisiana Downs by the time Corey was done. But, yeah, we've got a race meet that starts on February 15th, and it's a shame. We've had very good winter training weather up in Nebraska right now. Our main track will open on, Monday for training, and it wasn't supposed to open until the first week of January, but when the weather's nice, we make hay. So we've got horses filtering into the stable area, and we'll be ready to go come February 15th.
Update everybody on the status of, you know, the other Nebraska ovals and, you know, just how quickly and how soon, you know, the new Nebraska racing landscape will be in place.
Well, quickly, unfortunately, has not been in the lexicon of some of the other racetracks of late, but it's coming on, and that's good to know. You know, Fonner Park has been steady with our 12 weekends of racing. We'll have 31 days coming up. After we finish on Derby Day this year, Lincoln, that did put together 4 weekends of racing this past year, will follow us. So it'll be Derby Day will be our closing day, and then the following weekend, Lincoln's new racetrack will have their race meet. I think it's going to be of 4 weekends as well. And then Columbus, which had a dozen or so days of racing, they were in the fall, and it's hard to tell. They wanted to do a fall race meet for quite some time, and I don't know how that's going to play out, but frankly, guys, I mind my own business. I don't know what these other tracks are doing. I just keep my nose down and keep blowing. And we've had a concourse, because you've got a question about that before I talk about the casino. Yeah, Rick.
I thought I heard, is there a quarter horse track going in the western Nebraska?
There is, yes, in Ogallala. Our casino partner, Elite Casino Resorts, has partnered with those that had the license in Hastings, which is just 20 miles south of Grand Island. So we were tickled to death when they were going to move that license and get the hell out of our market area. So they're west of North Platte. So they'll catch all the people from Colorado that want to go and have a lake adventure at Lake Ogallala. It's a big summertime destination.
So the Hastings, that's the Hastings
yes.
project?
Yeah.
Got moved.
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
I have friends in Hastings, they keep asking me, well, you know what's going on with the, now I can tell them that's the one that's.
Right. So they're going to build a nice brand new facility, casino and racetrack there. Just one thing, we've been operating a beautiful temporary concourse casino at Fonner Park for the last 2 years, but come February or March, of this coming February or March, a gorgeous 7-story resort hotel casino will open about at our eighth pole, top of the stretch, basically.
Wow.
And with a spa and luxury dining, and it's going to be something, and it's going to help support our purses. But you guys all know this, there's a finite or diminishing number of horses in the United States, and we raised our purse money 17% for the 2024 meet that we had at the start of the year. And we got no new horses, and we're raising another 10% for this 2025 meet. And the phone's not ringing. Hey, can we have stalls? It's concerning, to say the least. We'll be paying $9,000 in person, no, $9,700 for open $5,000 claimers. That's good money for that level of horses.
And what's Maiden Special?
Maiden Special would be about 13 or 14, a little bit more for Nebraska breds. And I'm dying to get our Nebraska bred industry jump-started, because I don't care if we have three Nebraska bred races a day. If they fill races,
sure.
And that's how our people in the state are going to make money with the breeders' incentive programs.
Huh. Wow. I hate to hear that.
Sorry for the heavy news there.
I appreciate it.
Let me give you another look at that. So I believe that there are some emerging racing states, and I think Nebraska is one of them.
Re-emerging.
It takes a while. Wyoming is another one.
Yeah.
And so I believe, for example, we have five Wyoming-bred yearlings sired by Kentucky stallions that are going to race in Wyoming in 2025. Okay? Well, we need to work with Fauner Park because, you know, and the other racing entities in Nebraska. So I think it's going to be slow, Chris, but I think that you're going to continue to pick up momentum, and I think more horses are going to come to Wyoming and Nebraska.
Good. I welcome that. I was just talking with Darren Helt, the director of racing at Prairie Meadows, and he's asking, remember we had the friendship stakes at Louisiana Downs between the Archie breds and the Louisiana breds.
Yeah.
And I think this is going to have to be a coming together because of the thoroughbred situation right now as far as the population goes. And I'm all for Wyoming, and they're a little obscure little island out there because nobody gets to see them. They're not sending their simulcast signal out of state, sadly, much like Fauner is because of the HISA matter. But they're taking care of business there, and we're happy to have a strong partner.
Yeah.
But the Wyoming marketplace is going to burgeon, right? I mean, talk about this.
Real quickly, but you need to develop that circuit.
Yep.
And so when horses know, everyone's looking for, well, if I go here, what am I going to do for the rest of the year type of thing? When you develop that circuit, whether it be, you know, includes Wyoming and, you know, who knows, Turf Paradise and you, then people will jump into the merry-go-round because they know where they're going to go. And there's been a lot of uncertainty with some of the tracks, you know, questionable. Where am I going to go after I go here?
Well, I think that's why Columbus is thinking the fall, Corey, because Wyoming, you guys have some nice summer race dates, right?
Yeah. Yeah, we actually have a stallion, and you might remember his name is Dennis's Moment, and he's a graded stakes winner. And
Dale Romans.
Dale Romans.
Dennis Alba.
We stand him in Cheyenne, and one of the reasons we're in Cheyenne is we're hopeful that Nebraska breeders will you know, ban their mares to breed to Dennis, because Dennis is a good stallion for Nebraska bred or a Wyoming bred for sure. And so, and I think Chris is right. In Wyoming, it's the same way. We have to have a strong thoroughbred breeding program. And there's two reasons. Number one, it gives us horses, right? But secondly, it enhances our political and legislative clout. Because the one thing you'll find with a breeding industry is virtually every county in Nebraska will have a breeder and who knows a house, a representative or a senator. Same thing in Wyoming. And so what it does is it provides you with that political clout that is sometimes necessary to either, you know, get rid of your opponents, if you know what I mean, in a situation, or put your supporters together and, Chris, maybe get some extra money for breeders' awards.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what, Fauner Park is voluntarily contributing to the Nebraska bred program. There is no statutory requirement with this new casino industry that's come to Nebraska that provides for the breed program, which is kind of ironic, or it's hard to believe, but we know the importance of that. So 20% of what we allocate to horses and horsemen will go to the breeders for however they want to utilize it, including a thoroughbred aftercare program as well. I saw you visiting with Stacy earlier today.
So if I could hop in here, one of the best things we did at Kentucky Downs when we got HHR, a piece of the commissions from HHR went to the Kentucky Breeders Incentive Fund. That is something I am so glad. And the horsemen, they approved it, they supported it. And the other thing is, with that money that goes to KBIF, 7% goes to non-racing breeds, non-racing disciplines in the state. So now you widen your support throughout the state. It's worked famously in Kentucky, as we all know.
Well, and I'm going to let you riff on this, Corey. Corey Johnson and Chris Katulak helping us close out the visits here from the symposium, University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. And, of course, Corey's son, CJ, graduate, right?
Yeah. And he went here. He graduated from a college in Texas, but he went here.
He spent time here.
Yeah, he did.
And he enjoyed it.
Yes.
The Corey, you obviously, with Kentucky Downs, changed the landscape between Kentucky Downs and HHR in Kentucky, and of course, with what we had Louis Sella yesterday, and we talked about what his father accomplished with instant racing, and it obviously changed things for Oaklawn. There's been really a seismic shift in the circuitry, essentially, and it continues to be reshaped. And you've moved from project to project, to help codify and institutionalize these programs. Obviously, the experience as well in Virginia, talk about
Maryland.
Excuse me, yes. Talk about your view of where we stand, and how stakeholders, horse players, fans, need to understand, these shifting sands and kind of the reorientation of the game, based on where the money is.
Right. So I have a very optimistic view of thoroughbred racing based on five states. And we'll kind of elaborate. And I don't mean to leave out Nebraska, because what's going on in Nebraska and Wyoming is very important.
Sure.
And there was nothing there. And to the credit of Chris and the horsemen, they've really got a bright future, in my opinion.
There's a chance for a renaissance.
There really is, and you got Wyoming right next door. Okay, so let's go. New York, spending $400 million-plus on a new Belmont. A lot of money. Maryland, we have $450 million to build on a new Pimlico and a training center that's going to be world class.
We had Alan on Monday. We fleshed that
Virginia.
Right,
Virginia, Churchill Downs has spent hundreds of millions on gaming facilities, but they all lead to purses. So Virginia, that's a big number. Kentucky. Everybody understands Kentucky. But once again, Churchill and others, Winchell and Falcone, they've spent hundreds of millions on facility that once again, purses get their fair share, Steve. The key to all this is you got to make sure you treat the horsemen as your partners, and you got to put enough money in purses and breeders awards to make it all work.
Who's
and
the fifth state, right?
The fifth state
is
Arkansas. Lou Sella has done an amazing job.
Right.
He spent hundreds of millions of dollars in Oaklawn, and that's going to continue to go up. So there are five growth states where $2 billion plus has been invested in our industry. To me, that's a real positive. Now, Steve, you and I and Rick and Chris, we probably can give you 20 negatives about our industry, right? And we'll probably have 18 of the 20 would be the same. But we also need to look at the overriding positives that are going on. And that investment is huge. It's going to make sure that our industry is as strong, that will be stronger and stronger in spite of some of those negatives. And then I'm going to say one other thing. I think the recognition that we have to have a coordinated safety and integrity program is critically important. And I'm not telling you that recognition was there 5 years ago about the importance of it. And it's there. I can tell you this. We've taken over for the Stronic Group January 1st in Maryland. A very impressive part of their operation is horse safety, rider safety. I mean, there's a group of people at the Maryland Jockey Club that are totally dedicated to making it as safe as it could be. So based on that big investment, based on that recognition of safety and integrity, I'm a huge optimist.
And I would add, you know, you talk New York, Maryland, Virginia, Kentucky, and Arkansas. I would, if you want to call them, you know, the A's, I would say the B plus circuits of Louisiana, Oklahoma, and Indiana.
Yeah.
I mean, what's gone on at Indiana is spectacular. I talked to Matt Vance yesterday. I'll be in Remington tomorrow and Friday leading up to Springboard Mile. And then, of course, Louisiana, you got to call it vibrant. I mean,
absolutely.
There's four racetracks that are operating, and they've got a very good breeding program that actually, I mean, if there's one state that, you know, one regional program that has really seemingly raised their profile. I mean, Pennsylvania, I think, has done a spectacular job.
Right.
But Louisiana is the latest to start sending lawbreds out into the world to win graded stake races.
Right.
So, I mean, there's eight states that...
And, Steve, I want to be clear about this. There are, you've documented it. There are a number of states who are doing a good job. I was mostly talking about the new capital that's coming into our industry that's sizable. You know, these other states have already made that investment and are doing a really good job.
Or are just stable, have a stable scenario.
But are a necessary stable part of our industry.
Yeah, the money, the numbers you cited, Corey, that's huge, and it's good for the positive spin on with all the negative in the forest of negativity.
Well, if you take Churchill, and then when you fold in the new Belmont and the new Pimlico, the Triple Crown, the American Triple Crown in 2027, is going to be run at the three most modern and spectacular racetracks in the world.
Yeah.
Not in the United States. In the world.
Yeah.
And
that's correct.
I mean, that alone, I mean, the people that are going to come and potentially visit all three, whether it's in 1 year or whether they, you know, come over the course of their lives, and it, that alone is to be celebrated.
Correct. That is correct.
You know, I don't know. There's a crowd gathering behind us here right now. I don't know if it's because the show is ending, but I have to say something for the people who are listening and can't see. So Rick Hammerly's, he's got this sporty Kentucky Downs black zip-up top on and his Santa Anita cap, and Corey Johnson looks like he's just come from Newmarket or Keeneland with his cool-looking vest. I'm wearing a sport coat that I got in Santiago, Chile back in 1992. What do you think? Looks all right, guys?
92 looks great.
Yeah, and Steve Bick is wearing something I'll call a neoclassic sock hop or something. It looks very comfy, I have to say.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's actually, it's a Birdwell, you know Birdwell, the board shorts
it's cool.
Surfer. Yeah, it's a Birdwell sweater that... In fact, John Sakura complimented me on the sweater last year, and I sent him something similar for
What high school did you graduate from?
I went to Watkinson School.
You need a big W on that sweater, and then we're done.
Well, if you say that, and I'll put in a plug for our friend Varsity Styles.
Yeah, there you go.
He's doing jackets, collegiate jackets, but he's transferred it into using the colors. It was a brilliant idea, taking school colors essentially for barns for racing stables.
Yeah.
And he made a special one for Dale Romans with Dale's Diamond R. That logo, and he's done it for a number of barns.
What's it called?
Varsity Styles.
And that just Google it.
Rodney Styles and. He's
CJ Thoroughbreds. We got to get
that. All right. We'll hook you up. Yeah.
Well, you were bemoaning the Fawner Park koozie I gave you. Bring on the fawn this year. So next year I'll have something a little more upscale for you.
I didn't mean to.
I'm just kidding.
We love.
This is what has kept me in horse racing since I was walking hots for Glen Hill back at Exarban back in the 70s is the levity and the fun that you cannot take yourself too seriously in horse racing, because the next bad thing thing is right around the corner, and you got to survive it.
You were working for Tom Proctor or for
Glenn Hill? That was that's
yes, yes,
Glenn Hill. Did you say Glenn Hill?
And Glenn One Hill.
Of the trainer.
Bitterhook, free turn, Adenickel, Sisk.
Oh, my God. So,
yeah.
I forget it.
Well, a Silver Survivor, that was later on.
Yeah, but, he ran for because he had the Oakline Mammoth medal.
Yes.
That's where I worked at. I knew Glenn. He did most of the work himself.
Yes.
Or Sharon did.
Yeah.
You know, had the trailer, drove everywhere. He was like the, I don't say poor man's Dickie Small, but like because Dickie would get the trailer drive
at the later stages,
too.
Yeah. But believe me, we all worked our buns off for Glenn and Sharon.
Oh, I bet you did.
That was a taskmaster outfit there, but we had good success.
And I can't help but see you without saying one of the best books ever written about horse racing or a trainer.
Thank you.
From Grit to Glory about the Jack Vanberg story.
Are there some we'll put in that plug for a book too? Are there copies?
The website has kind of gone the way of the albatross now, but on Amazon you can still order a book, and I sell about one a month anymore now. But I'm kind of busy as a CEO, but I stop everything when that order when the little bling comes up on my email and says you've got a book sale. I'll stop and create the label and put it in the UPS.
Are there any signed left?
There are, and if someone wants to request that, they may. It's not the revised version, but it's a JVB signed copy. So I have some of those.
Well, if you want Jack Vanberg's autograph in the book, then it's available. That's great.
Call me at Fauner Park, people. We have a phone. It still works.
Let's give everybody the number.
You can Google us. It's 308-382-4515. But just call Fauner Park. It's on our website. We have a nice website.
Chris Katulak, everybody.
Thanks. It was worth the wait.
I just got a text from Bill Landis. He says he doesn't want your picture.
I'll tell you what. Bill Landis is absolutely one of a kind. When I went to Kentucky, he was a mentor to me. He did more to direct the success of Kentucky racing than, I mean, he was in that group. And he would, in his own way, he would make sure that we were heading in the right direction. If we got out of line as an industry, he would bring it back into line. Amazing, amazing gentleman.
Bill Landis, Brary Jones.
Yep. I mean, Brary Jones was a mentor to me, as you know, Steve. And he was the one that started it all with Keep. And, so it's a lot of people are involved. It's a family. That's the one thing I think Chris would mentioned. It's like a family,
sure.
And that's what makes it special.
Well, and that, as we get close to having to wrap up here from the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on racing, Hammer, all of you graduates, everybody that cycled through here, it's also a family in that regard, right? That's one thing that's so evident is how all the alum essentially, it's a fraternity / sorority that has had a half century of impact on the game.
Well, I guess when I got left here and went out in the world, I was one of those, you're one of those guys. People. Well, now there's a lot of us out there.
That's
and we
true.
Told the students in the little meeting we were talking about earlier, use us. We're there.
And
give
and
us
you've
a
made
call.
A pre- you've made
You're
a
looking
presence.
For a job. One of us is out there somewhere for you, so please use us. And it's amazing. I'm still meeting people that I didn't know went to the school, in between now.
Did you know Pat Pope had hair? Back in the day.
So did I. There's a couple of pictures floating around over
Abbey
up there. But I had hair. No, I did not. That was before me, so I didn't know that. But even I didn't even know Pat was here until I went to work for him.
Thanks for the kind words about the book, Rick. Good to see you, CJ. Steve, always a pleasure to be on your show. You guys do a terrific job.
Well, too kind. And I want to thank Corey Johnson and Chris Katulak. Earlier, we had Jay Hubdy and Aaron Grider with us. Lisa Lazarus cut out time for us as well on a busy day. A terrific visit with Rich Rosa from the Daily Racing Forum. We learned a lot about AI. And, of course, Bob Hartman, Robert Hartman, the program director. Stacy Clark Rogers as well. And Hammer, thanks to you and Dick for three terrific days. Thank you.
My pleasure. We'll do it again next year.
Absolutely. And probably won't... not going to be with you in person between now and the end of the year, but thanks for a fabulous season of co-hosting.
It's been a good one. We'll start anew next year.
We're going to send you out into the race day. Things pick up today. It's Wednesday, and We'll come to you tomorrow morning from Remington Park, Oklahoma City. Looking forward to getting down to Remington, another of the little tracks that could, and another place that that you had a hand in, Corey Johnson. Replay tomorrow, 6 to 9 here on SiriusXM Archive Podcast after some post-production. Thanks, everybody. Good luck if you're playing. We'll talk to you in the morning.
Breaking down the biggest stories in the world of horse racing. This is At the Races with Steve Bick on SiriusXM Radio.